Book session number 11338, Reel 1.
Captain Alec Ingle, Reel 1. If I could ask you first of all, Group Captain Ingle, about your entry into the RAF. Could you tell me about this? This, of course, would be before the war, I imagine.
Yes. I saw an advertisement in the Daily Mail in 1937, just a little, about one column inch. I don't think it was an advertisement, just an announcement that they were starting a reserve training school, a volunteer reserve training school at Brough in Yorkshire, quite nearby where I lived. And I thought this was a rather good idea. 1937, obviously, I was aware that things were brewing up a little, and seemed to be a very good idea to join the reserve and get some free flying. So I went along, had an interview, had a medical, and before I knew what was happening, I was flying Blackburn B-2s, little training aircraft, at Brough in Yorkshire. And I spent quite a lot of time there, weekends and things like that, and went solo and finished flying these little aeroplanes, and then started flying Hawker Harts and things like that. I suppose they were the obsolescent operational machines. I stayed there quite a time, got in about 100 hours flying, and then I moved to Lancashire, so I had no alternative then but to transfer to a similar training outfit, which was run by civilians but was a service organisation, at Barton in Manchester, where unfortunately I had to go back to flying very old Gypsy One Moths, which was a bit disappointing. But I had to do, I think it was either 14 or 15 days annual training a year, so when that came up, I got myself posted to Nottingham, where they had some of these more advanced types. And so I used to fly there. We eventually got some Harts and Hinds and Audaxes and things at Manchester when we moved from Barton to Ringway. In fact, we were probably the first aircraft that flew from Ringway.
How was the RAF Volunteer Reserve being built up in the year, you know, say 37 up to 39? Did you notice it yourself?
Oh yes, because there were new training centres opening all over the country. There were several around London, and they were dotted all over the country, and they attracted quite a lot of people at Brough. Well, some quite well-known wartime pilots were at Brough when I was at Brough, and the same at Manchester. And the thing was building up quite rapidly. We probably had about 50 pilots at Brough who came in intermittently, and at Manchester we were probably about the same. But by the time we got to 1938 and early 39, it was expanding quite rapidly. And it was a very, very good training scheme. It must have been very economical for the government to run, because they paid us a shilling an hour whilst we were there, and gave us 12 and sixpence a day when we're doing our 14 or 15 days training. And they gave us a retainer too, so there was a slight monetary inducement, but I don't think that really was, you know, the important thing. I think the important thing that we were flying, and it was very good indeed. The RAF were very good to us, very good to us indeed.
Would that have been sort of the main way a young man could fly in those days? You know, was it a very expensive hobby otherwise?
Oh, it was quite an civilian flying was quite expensive, and it certainly would have been beyond my reach to become a civilian pilot. There were quite a lot of flying clubs with quite a lot of people flying, of course, but this must have expanded the sort of amateur flying quite considerably before the war.
Did it relate to your work? You know, the
No, not at all. This was just my recreation. And I think that applied to all of us. We, if we could get any time off during the week, we used to be down, and in the summer evenings used to go down, and they were very accommodating. So we got in quite a lot of flying. By the time the war broke out, I had just over 200 hours flying, which was quite a lot of flying by standards of those days, so that it was very good indeed.
When war broke out, you know, was this expected by you? Had you been sort of following events?
Well, of course, after the Czech crisis in 1938, it was perfectly obvious something like that was going to happen. In fact, I personally thought we'd be at war in 1938, but it didn't come until 1939. But it was perfectly clear that it was coming, and it's as well the Air Force did what they did do.
Did your training involve studying the German Air Force?
Not really, not before the war. We were principally concerned with flying. You see, we really only had flying with facilities. We had no facilities for gunnery or anything like that. We had the theoretical training on it, and we did the normal theory that any of the other pilots did. Of course, the RAF ran the short service commission entry into the Air Force. There was entry into through Cranwell, which was the academic way of getting in, or from the universities and via the university air squadrons and so on. And then there was the short service commission, where, of course, that was the principal source of regular pilots in the Air Force before the war. They came in on a 5-year commission. I seriously thought about doing it myself, but probably if the war hadn't come when it did, I might well have taken a short service commission.
So how did the war affect you? You know, were you immediately mobilised?
Oh, well, I personally was called up on the 1st of September, and the first thing we did was to we went down to the airfield and flew all our aircrafts away and put them into a maintenance unit. So the minute war started, or from at the very outset of the thing, we had no aeroplanes to fly. I suppose the Air Force had got its plans to reallocate those into regular training units and that sort of thing, but I did nothing from... I got back to Manchester on the 3rd of September. In fact, I was just back in time to hear Neville Chamberlain's announcement on the 3rd. And then we reported about once a week to a headquarters we had in Manchester and waited for something to happen. And all the pilots who hadn't been trained at all, they all seemed to be called up, disposed of first. And quite a number of us who'd got quite a lot of flying in, we didn't do anything until about sometime around Christmas. And then they posted us to a unit up in Scotland, in Kinloss, where we flew monoplanes. Of course, we'd not been flying monoplanes, we were all biplanes before that. And half the people there went on flying twin-engine aircraft, and presumably under bombers and things, and a number of us preferred single-engine aircraft, so we went to fighters. We then moved to... we completed that course, and they commissioned us and posted us to operational squadrons, and I was posted to 605 Squadron, which is an auxiliary Air Force squadron. That was, of course, the auxiliaries were the other... well-established squadrons who were, in fact, practically as trained operationally as the regular squadrons were. But I was posted into one of these squadrons as a replacement for some of the pilots they lost over Dunkirk. They reformed at Drem, and I was posted up there, and a very good squadron it was too. A very good squadron commander, a squadron leader, Churchill, who was an auxiliary. Oh, I thought absolutely first rate. And
What planes were you flying?
We were flying Hurricanes then. We flew Hurricanes.
Mm. How did you take to the Hurricane? You know, what was your opinion of it?
Oh, it was a very nice aeroplane. It was a gentlemanly aircraft. A very, very good aeroplane, and of course it would take a tremendous amount of punishment. It was a very sturdy aeroplane, and a very, very pleasant aircraft to fly. No, there was no great problem about flying those. It was a pleasure to do it.
And what was your, you know, what were you doing in Drem? What was your role?
Well, we had to become operational again because the squadron had been decimated after the Dunkirk thing. So, some of the pilots drifted back out of hospital and, you know, back from France and that sort of thing. They'd been operating from Hawkinge, but I think a few of them were lost over France. And some of them drifted back, some of them came back from hospital, the squadron was re-established, really, with a few of auxiliary pilots, but they were mainly reservists, like myself.
Well, was that a blow to morale?
Not at all.
Dunkirk, what happened at Dunkirk?
No. I don't know. It may have been to some, but certainly as far as we were concerned, it cleared the air, rather.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there was so much, it was difficult to know what was going on in France. It didn't seem to be a properly organised battle, really. Once we got the channel between us and the enemy, then of course the situation became very clear and very positive. No, it was, as far as I was concerned, naturally, you got that sinking feeling now and again, oh dear, 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 another disaster. But it certainly didn't affect morale, as far as I could see. I never heard anybody, bemoaning what was happening or being gloomy about it. And we were there to do a job and we thought, well, here we are. This is where we get down to it. In fact, it pervaded throughout the whole war. I've been listening to some of the programs recently and on the television. In fact, there was one a couple of nights ago about what was going on in 1940 and the disputes between Chamberlain and Halifax and that sort of, between Churchill and Halifax and that sort of thing, and how there were indications the morale of some people in the country was low and they wanted to more or less throw their hand in. But I, at that time, of course I was young, well, relatively, I never got any indication that that was anybody's feeling. There was a situation and we were young and we had to deal with it. It was quite simple, really. Like, things are a bit simpler when you're young, I think. It was obviously very serious, but I think probably some more... the fall of Singapore had more impact than that at that time. It was all relative to what was going on around you. No problems.
Was there a clear-cut sort of signal that the phony war had ended, do you remember?
Oh, I think so, yes. I think we thought, now we've hit the bottom. We've got to, it's quite clear-cut what's got to be done now. And you couldn't see how, at that time, how we could invade Europe again. Obviously this would have to come. The important thing at the time was keeping the Germans out. That was going to be a job in itself. We could consider the other things later, or somebody else could consider them, but our principal job, as far as I could see, was to keep the Germans at bay until we got ourselves reorganised.
But I suppose this brings us really to the Battle of Britain, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose so, yes. Of course, being up in Scotland, the Battle of Britain started in about July. By that time, we'd become accepted as a fully operational squadron again. And we were doing the interception of odd raids, or X-rays, as they were, indications that there are many aircraft about, and we tried to intercept them, but we very rarely saw anything. In fact, I don't recall seeing anything at all on the various X-raids I went to intercept. We did quite a bit of convoy patrolling up and down, well, convoys going down the East Coast and coming out of the further forth and that sort of thing. We did night patrols and so on, just in case anything was around. I think that was more getting experience than serving any really practical purpose. But it was all part of the build-up. And then, of course, on funeral, sometime in July or August, there was a raid on Newcastle, one of the very early raids, and we were scrambled more or less out of the blue. And we went down to intercept this thing, and the squadron was engaged there. We landed back at Accrington, and that really started the thing. A few of the people of the squadron, of course, had been in Dunkirk, and they knew much more about it than we did. I mean, they'd fired their guns in anger. We hadn't. In fact, when the whole thing started, the only time I fired my guns, all I knew about or experience of shooting the aircraft was I was sent up to shoot a stray barrage balloon, which was drifting away from the Firth of Forth. I think that was the first time I fired my guns, until we had to fire them in anger when we got down to Croydon. But that was the start of the thing, and then we watched the other squadrons. They went down before us. 602 squadron were at Drem with us. That's the Glasgow squadron. And they went down, came down here to Tangmere, West Hampton. And then we sort of cooled our heels until early days in September, when we were told to fly down to Croydon.
Well, what did you think about that, you know, cooling your heels, when you must have known what was going on further south?
Yes, I suppose so. We knew that our turn would come. After all, there weren't so very many squadrons, and they'd got to be rotated, and we knew that our turn would come, and somebody had to be up in Scotland in case anything went on up there. I mean, there were squadrons even further north, up at Wick and places like that. So everybody couldn't be down there at once, and I suppose, waited our turn. And our turn came in early September. We went down to Croydon. Then, of course, it livened up quite a lot.
You would have been involved, I imagine, with the defence of London then, would you, at that stage?
Well, the whole of the South East, really, you see. We flew down to Croydon, and that was a fairly horrific sight, actually. We refuelled at Abingdon, I think it was, and then we flew right over the top of London at about, I suppose, 6,000-7,000 feet, just above the balloons. And the whole of the East End was ablaze. You could look right down the river, and the whole thing was sort of smoky and on fire. And, of course, your heart did go into your boots then, when you saw that lot. You know, it was a terrible sight. And we landed down on Croydon, and 111 Squadron, I think it was there. And well, no, they'd flown out to be relieved, but they'd left their ground crew behind to receive us. And they looked after us for a few days until our own ground crews arrived. And then, of course, we were tucked away in the airport hotel at Croydon, the old airport hotel. But we only stayed there one night because the CO decided this was not a very safe place to be, to have all his pilots concentrated in such an obvious target. So we organised. We took over a complete street of houses on the opposite side, Forrester's Drive. And from my recollection, there were only about three of those houses occupied. Practically everybody had gone, and in some of them there were even sort of remains of the breakfast on the table. But we established ourselves there. We had a mess in number 39 Forrester's Drive. and we lived in the various houses round about, and we dispersed our aircraft on the west side of the airfield round there. The dispersals were tents, with no huts or anything like that. We were working from tents as far as the dispersal went. But it was all right. It was, if you recall, the weather was very good in September 1940. In fact, it was remarkably good. And we operated from our tents very happily. The troops seemed very happy, and we were fairly busy. In fact, there were shelters around the place to go to, but I, for one, never went in them, and I don't think very many people did. And one night the Germans dropped a stick of bombs right across our particular dispersal, and I slept through it, as did most people, I think. It was you just got accustomed to it, and as far as the flying concerned, we were busy. We were quite busy. We were operating under control from Kenley, we were a sort of subsidiary satellite to Kenley, Croydon. And I think it was 72 Squadron was there with Spitfires. They'd been bombed out of Biggin Hill, and they were in Croydon just for a short time. They were only there for a few days, from what I can recall. And then we were more or less on our own. We had Croydon to ourselves. I don't know, I got quite attached to Croydon.
Could you give me an idea of, say, a typical day during the most intense period? Can you sort of think back, I wonder?
Well, you see, the squadron was given one of three states. A state of readiness. They're all states of readiness, I suppose, but you're at readiness, which meant that you had to be able to get into your aircraft and get into the air in about 2 minutes. You could be at standby, where you had to sit in your cockpits and keep the engine warmed up and that sort of thing. You could then be at 15 minutes readiness or at 30 minutes readiness. And what happened was, we would get messages from the ops room at Kenley, which would tell us what state we're going to be in, and we'd know whether we had to be on at dawn, in readiness at dawn, or whether we'd half an hour. If half an hour, you see, you can be fairly relaxed. And then at a certain time, as they stood some squadrons down, they'd bring other squadrons up, and you were told of what state you had. And then, when you were wanted, they'd just say, if you're at readiness, they'd say, Turkey Squadron. We were Turkey Squadron. Turkey Squadron scramble and patrol where Ashford or something like that, 20,000 feet, and off we'd go. We'd all run to our aircraft, and we had our parachutes draped over the wings, so you just ran underneath the wing and clipped your parachute on and clambered into the cockpit. Your ground crew tucked you in, and you started up, and off you went, and you flew off as a squadron. You did it all very, you know, you got it down to a fine art. It could be done very quickly. Of course, it didn't always work like that, because you could be at 30 minutes, and the next thing you'd hear would be Turkey Squadron come to readiness, scramble. So that then there was a bit of rushing around to be done. But it was all part of the thing. And the unfortunate thing was, most of it seemed to occur, you'd be just having breakfast, and you'd get a scramble. It always seemed to occur at meal times. I don't know why. It always seemed to me to be occurring at meal times. And off you'd go.
Was it a very intense pace, though? You know, were you being called to scramble all the time, did it seem?
Well, I don't know. I think the most you would do about four times in the day. But it wasn't normally quite as intense as that, because you had to do your periods at various other states too, you see. You couldn't have all the... There were occasions when CNC fighter commander got every one of his aircraft up, all his squadrons up. But he couldn't afford to do it. He couldn't risk that, because the raids were coming in. It worked out quite... quite reasonably. You didn't get overtired, but on the other hand, you hadn't got a lot of spare time.
Also, I wonder how you regarded these. You know, as you say, you were a very young man at the time.
Oh, I was old. I was old for the squadron.
Yes, so
I was 24 when in 1940. So I was one of the older people around the place, and of course I was relatively one of the more experienced flyers because I'd got so many flying hours in before the war.
But you know, did you were you frightened of going up ever?
No, you weren't frightened of going up. You were apprehensive rather than frightened. The first flight you made in the morning, you would get a sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach. Until you saw the enemy, and the minute you'd made your first interception, for the rest of that day, it didn't matter what happened. Something had happened, you know, the adrenaline flowed, and it must have certainly, as far as I was concerned, it was flowed in reasonable quantity because that kept me going for the whole day. But the first flight in the day was always the worst. And it was only bad, well, it wasn't bad, but you were apprehensive until you'd seen the enemy and seen what you'd got to do and pressed your gun button. Then, for the rest of the day, you could have taken on the complete Luftwaffe. It was, that's the reaction I had to it.
Well, I suppose you did, really, didn't you?
Well, I don't know. We did our little bit, I suppose.
Were they, you know, very heavily protected, the German flights coming in?
Oh, yes. It was quite interesting, actually. When you saw them for the first time, it was like seeing an enormous swarm of bees coming towards you, with some big fat bees and some little thin bees. And what happened was, you'd see these Heinkel 111s or Dornier 17s or something like that, and they'd come ploughing along in this stolid formation. I think they're probably doing about 160, 180 miles an hour, and you were coming in the other direction generally. And above them, you'd see all these little specks, which were the 109s. And they were the devils you had to watch, of course. But we developed a technique wherever we could. We just used to take them head on because, trying to attack them from a quarter or chasing them didn't seem to be a very profitable thing. And in any case, it probably had the best effect to take them head on because it must have been fairly unnerving to see a whole line of aircraft coming straight at you and attacking you.
Was that your own technique, you know, your particular squadron's technique, or was it a more general?
Oh, I think it was fairly general. There were prescribed types of fighter attacks, 1, 2, 3, and 4, but I think most squadrons threw that out of the window and adapted their tactics to suit their own requirements and suit the requirements in the sky. And you hadn't time to start doing anything elaborate. When you saw these people, of course, you closed on them at quite a rate. You tried to get yourself, as you were climbing up, you tried to get yourself into an advantageous position, but you couldn't always do that. You know, you never seemed to be scrambled early enough because you'd get warning that something was building up over Saint-Omer or something like that. And you'd be scrambled and you'd go in the direction they told you, because we seemed to look after a sector which was round sort of Tunbridge Wells down towards Dover and more or less due south of us down towards Brighton, and then of course there'd be the Northolt squadrons. I suppose they would be looking after the bits on our right, and they North Weald squadrons would be looking the bits over the Thames estuary and the Hornchurch squadrons, and so that we generally were flying over Kent and East Sussex. That was our general area, though we did occasionally get as far as coming to have a look at what was going on over Portsmouth. but generally it was in that area. And you would hear these, you would be told that these people were coming off and they'd be 60 plus or 70 plus and so on. And they'd indicate when they're coming towards you. Well, of course, by the time you'd got yourself up, you tried to get above 20,000 feet, so you're above them. But of course, on more occasions than not, you didn't succeed in making it. In fact, on some, you were climbing into them as they came, which was a bit difficult. You couldn't generally manoeuvre position or anything. You anything like that. Occasionally, that would work out like that. But generally, you're headed towards the enemy and.